The three gavels, as you know, is the tradition of the Commonwealth Club. So that means we have officially begun our evening of the 78th Annual California Book Awards. And my name is Roy Eisenhart. I'm a member of the Book Awards jury. And it's so gratifying for me and for many of the jurors who are here that I'll introduce in just a second to look out and see all your faces, because we've been working pretty hard since towards the end of last year to make these selections. And this is kind of our feeling, like it's when we rise from the ashes and it actually happens. I think the only people who are probably more excited than we are the authors who will be getting their awards tonight, and that's certainly appropriate. Before I forget it, there is going to be a raffle of an entire set of the winning work, so save that little ticket stub that you had and... too late, huh? Well, I don't... Somebody is going to have to solve that problem. Maybe everybody will win. Let me just say a word about the process of the selection of the books, because I think it actually is really quite interesting. It's actually a very hard job to come down and pick what you as a group, our jury, thinks is the best fiction book written in California this year. I mean, if you think of it, that's a very tight narrowing. And we have a very interesting process where our jurors are divided into reading into categories. So we'll have three or four jurors reading all the fiction. We'll have three or four jurors reading all the nonfiction, the juvenile, the young adult. And the fiction readers also read the first fiction. And then each of those groups makes a selection of what they think are the top candidates, usually about five. And then we as a jury all read all of those books. And we get together, and since there's about 500 books in the thing, you can imagine that this is somewhat of a formidable task. But we get together, and we have a wonderful meeting where the goal is to achieve a consensus as to the finalists. And usually we will give a gold medal and a silver medal, so that we have some way. We don't have to just pick one. We can pick the silver medalist. So it's quite an interesting process, and of course one that's been going on for the Commonwealth Club for a long time. And given the richness of literature in the state of California, I mean, just the size of this state, 35 or whatever the right number is, million people, no comment about the economy right now, but at least we have a lot of people. And that the presence of so many fine universities, that the quality of the books that we get is really, really overwhelming. And as a juror, it's really a lot of fun to be required to read a lot of these. So I want to read off the names of the jurors, because I think they deserve a special little round of applause. In alphabetical order, David Hellman, Mary Ellen Hannibal, Martha Cox, John McMurtry, Oscar Villalone, Justin Chin, Susan Waldman, Catherine Gilmartin, Jewel Gomez, Dean Rader, Grace Ruth, and David Ulan. So let's hear it for them. Thank you. And as already hinted, we will be giving out awards in fiction, nonfiction, poetry, young adult, juvenile, first work of fiction, and then two special categories, Californiana and contribution to publishing. We have changed. Some of you are familiar with the process in the past, so I want to tell you about a small change we made this year. It used to be that first fiction, let me start a different way. Fiction and nonfiction and poetry were eligible for gold medals. Everything else was eligible for silver medals. That never made any sense, but we never did anything about it. And finally, this year, we did do something about it. And now every book in every category that is the winner gets a gold medal. In some categories, there are also silver medals, and in some categories, there is only a gold medal. But so you will see now, for example, this year, the first work of fiction, the one that was the winner, will get a gold medal. And we're really happy to have the nomenclature be consistent across the spectrum. We are going to now turn the mic over to our Master of Ceremonies, Julia Flynn Seiler. But before I do that, I just want to thank two people who work for the Commonwealth Club and make this whole thing happen, and that's Gina Bellaria. Gina, where are you hiding? Somewhere. She's really hiding. Oh, there she is. Gina is actually standing up, but it's not clear. And our intern, Isla Foley, who really helped put this event together, and we thank you, Isla, wherever. Oh, here, you're up here. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so, Julia, would you like to come up and take over from me? Thank you very much, everyone.
Well, thank you. Welcome to the California Book Awards. It's my very great honor to take part in this evening's celebration of the rich literary talent that exists in our state. The California Book Awards began in the early days of the Depression. 1931 was the first award given. One of the first writers it recognized was a journalist turned author named John Steinbeck. As you may remember, John Steinbeck was out reporting for a San Francisco newspaper and became outraged over the plight of the state's migrant workers. The Commonwealth Club awarded Steinbeck three gold medals during the 1930s, and one of those was for The Grapes of Wrath, with its unforgettable characters Ma and Pa Jode and Rosa Sharon. As you may remember, The Grapes of Wrath was a book that was banned and burned in the Salinas Valley after it was published in 1939, allegedly for being obscene. Well, in the midst of that controversy, the club decided to award its gold medal that year to this novel that portrayed the Golden State in a less than golden light. And it came under a lot of fire for doing that. But it didn't back down. It believed from the start that literature should not be bullied. And, of course, the rest of the world caught up with the club. The Nobel Committee awarded The Grapes of Wrath its prize for literature more than two decades later, in 1962. So, as we struggle through another period of great turmoil in our state, with tense cities spreading outside of Sacramento and other parts through the valley, California authors have kept on writing and publishing hundreds of books that touch almost every aspect of the human experience. As Roy mentioned, our judges spent months reading many, many books. They're volunteering their time to do this out of a belief in the power of the written word. And so with sincere thanks to our panel of judges, as well as to the astonishing array of authors who are here tonight, let's begin. And we'll begin with fiction. I'm tiptoeing, so I'm going to... standing my tiptoes. The finalists are Mitch Cullen for The Post-War Dream, Andrew Sean Greer for The Story of a Marriage, Ron Hansen for Exiles, Ona Russell for The Natural Selection, and this year's gold medalist is someone who's written a family story that explores the heart-wrenching struggle between art and love. With irreverent wit and kinetic prose, he's woven together the stories of three characters separated by a generation and geography, whose lives echo one another across both time and space. So congratulations to Adam Mansbach, the gold medal winner in fiction for The End of the Jews. Yeah, come on up. Don't be shy, Adam.
Good evening. You know, I'm glad to see there is an actual medal because I was planning on making a real fuss if there wasn't. However, it appears to be embedded in some kind of oblong shape, which means I can't wear it around my neck as I was planning to do. I was going to be completely insufferable about this whole thing, you know, more so. You know, hey, Adam, can you go out tonight? Well, let me talk to the metal. Let's see how the metal feels. I was also hoping that I wouldn't have to go first because I didn't really know what I was expected to do. I figured I would take my cue from my fellow award winners, and if they read something, I would read something. So I guess it's up to me to set a precedent. So I will, in fact, read a short excerpt from the work, if everyone is okay with that. Yeah? Okay. So I'm going to read a piece that takes place in 1989 when two young men are DJing a bar mitzvah. Now, this is not what they set out to do when they purchased their turntables and other sundry equipment. They were sure they would be engaged to play at parties far hipper than this one, but the only gigs they can seem to get in suburban Connecticut are at these bar mitzvahs. Their names are Risk and Zone. Sweet. I was hoping it'd be you guys. Risk looks up from the wires he's de-jumbling to see Zone extend a hand. Apple-cheeked Adam Silverberg, coolest kid on the bar mitzvah circuit, slaps him an enthusiastic five. What up, Ad Rock? Inquires Risk. Adam shrugs. The red knit tie he wears to every bar mitzvah is stained with something pinkish, probably last week's salmon cream cheese. You guys need anything? My man, says Zone. Can you hook us up some plates? With Adam in attendance, they can eat without looking like derelicts for abandoning their station. He's thrilled to be the kid who gets to hang out with the DJs, more than happy to run errands to the buffet tables and even the bar. Under the quiet tutelage of the senior half of Risk Zone Productions, Ad Rock has become a proficient, gleeful thief of alcohol. His reward, aside from the satisfaction of a job well done, is exemption from the dumbass kit games the kids will eventually cajole Risk and Zone into orchestrating. He jogs across the empty dance floor, untied shoelaces flapping, and joins the just-formed lunch line. Zone back cues Risk Zone Productions theme music, nudges the volume on the mixer up to 2, the proper volume at which to blend it with the buzz of conversation, and lets the record play. A 6-note minor key piano riff falls over heavy drums, and Risk smiles the way he does every time they set a party off like this with the most wildly, yet subtly inappropriate bar mitzvah platter in the crates. Why is that off the new Boogie Down Productions album? KRS-One's chapter and verse breakdown of biblical lineage in service of the argument that Moses was black. Nobody but Zone, Risk, and Adam is listening to the lyrics, but something in Risk needs to perform this ritual, mount this unreceived challenge. His place is here, behind the turntables with Zone, and no matter how many of his parents' friends might come over to say hello, Risk will never step out from behind his barrier to greet them. He is hired help, and Moses was black. Adam returns, a plate in each hand and a cloth napkin and silverware roll poking from each trouser pocket. Risk sets his rations to one side. Zone digs in. He adores bar mitzvah food. It's your turn to do Coke and Pepsi, Risk informs him preemptively. Zone shovels down a hacked-off chunk of noodle kugel, shakes his head. I did it last time. Bullshit, you did not. Unspoken between them is the fact that Zone has much more cool to spare, but the acknowledgement comes a moment later in the form of Zone's agreement to sacrifice some of it by emceeing the contest. He is something of a folk hero here on the bar mitzvah circuit. The more aggressively liberal father types make a point of coming over one by one to shoot the shit with him, crack a few jokes, and Zone delights them by being just a regular guy. The bejeweled, pantsuited women inquire as to whether he has had enough to eat, and Zone charms them with his enthusiasm for the spread, tells them he's eaten so much already that he's half Jewish. If he's feeling especially gregarious, he might even toss off a couple of mazel tovs, blow everybody's mind. The kids vie for his attention, dashing over to slap him five and then retreating triumphantly into their edge of the dance floor gaggles. Zone ushers them into the circle of his hipness, dubbing them homeboy, homegirl, my man. Everybody sneaks quick, fascinated looks at his pencil-thin, shoulder-length dreadlocks. Coke, Zone shouts into the Radio Shack microphone 45 minutes later as Risk hits the turntable stop button. 30 full-bellied adolescents sprint the length of the parquet to sit on the knees of their crouched, waiting partners. Pepsi, everyone races the other way. 7-Up, 60 kids reverse direction halfway across the floor, lurch back the way they came. Eventually, the field is narrowed to one winning couple, two dudes who take the contest way too seriously. So seriously that they don't realize the whole point is to partner up with a girl. Twice, elderly women ask Zone to lower the volume, claiming their conversations are being impeded. Thrice, Risk is forced to apologize for not having Hava Nagila, the song to which the Hora is danced. Finally, getting into the make-do spirit that sustained their forefathers through 40 years in the desert with nothing to eat but manna and more fucking manna, the revelers organize themselves into a circle anyway and find a chair on which to hoist the bar mitzvah boy, those footing the bill, and the parents of those footing the bill. Zone throws on the instrumental B-side to Eric B. and Rakim's Microphone Fiend, a proven substitute because it has hand claps and the partygoers pause, palms poised and ready to clap rigidity, then cock their heads and don complainy faces. Risk nudges Adam. Set it off. Adam nods through a couple of bars, getting his bearings, then bangs his palms together and bellows, Hava, Nagila, Hava, to the beat. The crowd joins him on the second go-round, drowning out the record. The circle spins, the chair is raised. Zone pats Adam on the shoulder, turns his back to the dance floor, and pours himself a glass of straight Bacardi from the half bottle the kid liberated from the bar. He downs a slug and passes the cup to Risk, who opens his throat and drains it. Thanks.
Oh, that was great. I love that. Our next award is for Contribution to Publishing, which honors a publishing house for its contribution to the literary landscape. This year, we are honoring a house that has crafted a collection that illuminates a long overlooked period of art history. For its innovative achievement in examining all facets of Asian American art, we give the gold medal in Contribution to Publishing to Asian American Art, a History, 1850 to 1970, written by authors Gordon H. Chang, Mark Dean Johnson, and Paul J. Carlstrom. And accepting the award will be Paul Carlstrom. Okay. Congratulations.
Thank you. Where's mine? I wouldn't wear that thing under any circumstances. It doesn't work for me. This is... I'm now deciding, am I going to read something from this book? Like maybe the beginning of my chapter? Oh, no? Okay. First of all, I'm delighted to be here. And I'm part of a team. It's the main thing to tell. There's not one name on this book, and I think this is the exception here. I'm not quite sure. There seem to be single authors. And we were a team, and a big team, and a project that covered probably 15... maybe 18 years. So it's that kind of a book where enormous amount of information is gathered to basically lay and create, the field exists, but in terms of the study of the phenomenon, it didn't exist, and that's Asian American art. This is the first history. It's interesting that that the whole project was started and in the initial stages was directed by Mark Johnson and Paul Carlstrom. Okay, two guys, white guys, Swedish American. I think that this is worth mentioning, and it was in my home, in my kitchen, with Mark and his wife Maria and Anne, who's here, and I were... chatting, and my wife, who's smart, said, have you guys thought about this book that you say you're going to be doing? And we said, yeah, a lot. We talk about it all the time. It's so exciting. She said, well, in this world, in this climate,
you may have problems. Two Swedish Americans. And so we immediately said, oh, my God, you're right. Whether we really would have had problems or not, I don't know. But luckily, we found Gordon Chang, who's the third co-editor. Mark and Gordon obviously are not here. Otherwise, one of them maybe would be receiving. But at any rate, we found Gordon, who was thrilled to be involved. He was head of Asia. He's an historian, head of Asian American Studies at Stanford. And what he said turns out to be true. And I think we got it. But this project that Mark and I, Mark, first of all, then I joined him quickly, that we were involved in and worked so hard on with an NEH grant, we had no idea that it would turn into this beautiful book. And it is a beautiful book. And Wilstead and Taylor should, represented here tonight, should get supreme kudos for that. I get no credit for that. A team effort. But Gordon Chang really put it right out there. He said, this is going to be a major contribution in Asian American studies. And it's nice to be able to be so effusive and go on about this book. I can do it because I'm just part of this team. And there were graduates, not even graduate students, undergraduate, some graduate students involved in the process. It started out with this. I'm not going to give you the whole history, but it started out modestly trying to just get information where there was absolutely none. There were no art historians who knew anything about this field. We knew a little bit because Mark and I had taken special interest. And these students, starting out at San Francisco State and then down at UCLA, a team was put together, and then, of course, at Stanford. And Stanford, of course, is a big partner in this because of major funding to make it possible to carry it through, and then, of course, the press. There are all these parts. I want to mention one key person. That's Sharon Spain, who worked with Gordon and Mark and with me in really keeping track of all this and bringing it together. And then, of course, there are a whole series of authors. And they're some of the top people in the what now is recognized as a field. I'm not going to read from the book, although I recommend that you buy it. And I encourage you to start not at the beginning, but with the chapter on modernism. I think you'll find it well worth it. It's a wonderful way to start that book. Not just because I wrote it. What I do want to say, and I don't have to read it to tell you this, that it was a very difficult book to do at this time because it's an artificial grouping of Americans, Asian Americans. Well, they don't even necessarily get along. They certainly don't in Asia and, to a degree here. And they don't self-identify necessarily that way. But when you're starting out wanting to establish a field or to suggest work that needs to be done, you have to do this. That's what historians do. They group, they organize so that we can understand, have a starting point. And this was a real problem. And so I started the modernism chapter by talking about that as a problem. What do you say about this? What's the excuse for doing this, putting these people together? It's almost like ghettoizing, which is not something we're supposed to do if we're sensitive to our fellow Americans. Anyway, this is how this book came together. We're thrilled to be honored by the Commonwealth Club, no question about it. And I have to say that I knew the Commonwealth Club mainly because of NPR and listening to the programs. And I never wanted to. I've received things in the mail. I never wanted to join because I thought it was so intimidating. And I listened to this, and I heard questions from the audience, and I said, God, I would never dare to ask that kind of a question. But it looks pretty friendly to me. Anyway, thank you so much.
Congratulations to Stanford University Press and the team of authors that put this extraordinary book together. The cover alone is gorgeous. The next award is in the juvenile category, and the finalists this year are Matt Faulkner for A Taste of Colored Water, Megan McDonald for The Hinky Pink, I particularly like that title, and Yuyi Morales for Just in Case. This year's gold medal goes to a story which reveals the stirring history of the Negro League baseball team. Through a rich narrative and beautiful illustrations, the author celebrates the hundreds of ballplayers who overcame hatred and appalling conditions to follow their passions. The gold medal in juvenile literature goes to We Are the Ship, the story of the Negro League Baseball by Kadir Nelson. Mr. Nelson could not be here with us tonight, but congratulations to him. Yay! Next, we're on to our young adult winner. And the finalists are Michael Cadnam for The King's Arrow, Sid Fleischman for The Trouble Begins at 8, Neil Schusterman for Ancy Does Time, Sari L. Smith for Hot, Sour, Salty, Sweet. This sequel to her acclaimed book, The Green Glass Sea, follows the narrator as she adjusts to a new family and a new life near the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico in 1946. For her book, White Sands, Red Menace, we give a gold medal in young adult literature to Ellen Klages. Oh, she's got a cheering section.
Tiny microphone. I'm not going to read from my book because when my editor found out that this book had won an award, she said, good, the paperback's coming out. You have to do a speech so we have something to print in the back. So I have a speech. This is such an amazing honor. I looked at the list of people who have won the California Book Award since 1931, and I was just flabbergasted to be in the same category as any of them. So I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for celebrating the work of California writers for almost 80 years, and for this year's jury for including me in that distinguished company. I'm grateful for my editor, Sharon November, who took a chance on a very unusual first novel, The Green Glass Sea, and believed me when I told her that there was more to the story. And I'd like to thank my friend Neil Gaiman for not being a resident of California this year. It makes things so much easier for the rest of us. It is especially gratifying to get this award for White Sands, Red Menace because it is a sequel, and they are often ignored stepchildren. It's a coming-of-age story, which is a fairly common motif in YA literature. Like To Kill a Mockingbird and Member of the Wedding, it features a young girl, two in this case, crossing the border out of childhood. And that's a one-way trip, as innocence is irrevocably replaced by knowledge and responsibility. What makes this story a bit more complex is that it's not just Dewey and Suze who come of age, but science and the world itself. The book takes place in a forgotten period of U.S. history, just after World War II. It often seems that the 1940s are the only five-year decade we had, because most sources have the end of the war, and then suddenly it's the 50s, as if nothing happened in between. And in truth, nothing much did, which is an interesting time to set historical fiction. But coming-of-age stories are about journeys, and they're about times of transitions and beginnings, like 1946 and 1947, the beginning of the atomic age. The scientists who've created the bomb must deal with the consequences of the Pandora's box that they have opened, and the public must come to terms with the horrors of Hiroshima and the possibility of sudden death on an unimaginable scale. In the New Mexico desert, engineers and the Army start to piece together captured V-2 bombs, the ones that devastated London in the Blitz and cost the lives of 20,000 slaves in the Nazi concentration camp where they were built. Over the next few years, German and American engineers and scientists will transform those weapons into rockets, whose descendants will one day take a man to the moon. It's the beginning of the space age. It's a time when science fiction is becoming fact, when modern marvels begin to make the leap from lurid pulp magazine pages to people's kitchens and living rooms. Televisions and microwave ovens are just around the corner for the family of the future, if there is a future. Because these years are also the beginning of the Cold War, the Red Scare that will define the rest of the 20th century, the fear that commies might be everywhere and the sky could rain death at every moment. No, nothing much actually happens in 1946 and 47. It's the eye of the storm, Everything has just changed, and everything is about to change again. The future has never been more promising or more uncertain. But, you know, that mix of dreams and the unknown, that's what a coming-of-age story is about, isn't it? That's page two. I want page three. There's a myth of a nostalgic past that 60 years ago the world was a simpler place, and in many ways it was. Imagine a time without freeways or the internet, when no one knew that smoking was bad for you, and women, blacks, and Mexicans were considered second-class citizens. Simpler is not always better. In White Sands, Red Menace, I try to give the reader a backstage tour of the past as it really was, no whitewash, the stories that are not often told to children. But they are my audience, and they are on their own journeys, becoming young adults, taking the first steps into a future that many of us will never see. So I want them to know how much things have changed in the last 60 years, and to think about how their own choices will create the world of 2069. As a writer, it's not my job to give kids answers, but to pique their curiosity, make them want to find out more, to explore, discover, argue, discuss, and most importantly, to ask questions. Ask a lot of questions. That, I hope, is my gift to the future. Thank you for helping me share it.
The award for the warmest fan club thus far. Yay! We now move on to first fiction. It's a very important award. It honors a writer for a strong effort in their very first novel. For this year's first fiction submissions, they were so strong we decided to bestow an award on another book in this category to ensure that both works received recognition. First, our finalists, Selden Edwards for The Little Book, Zoe Ferraris for Finding Noof, Jess Winfield for My Name is Will, and the Silver Medal for First Fiction is awarded to this author for his extraordinary collection of stories that trace the shifting legends of a dead father in the backwoods of Alaska. These stories show the events and repercussions of a father's suicide through the eyes of his son. So for his books, The Legend of a Suicide, we award a silver medal in first fiction to David Vann.
Well, thank you. Thanks to the Commonwealth Club and the committee who read all those books. And I'd like to thank my mom, Lorraine Vann, who's in the audience. Before I could even write, my mom was asking me to tell stories about squirrels and then writing them down. So it's all started early, and there's a brief cameo appearance by a squirrel in one of the stories. I thought I'd read just a short three-minute section, a scene from the first story in the collection, Ichthyology, which just means the study of fish. I abandoned ship one night when my father was crying alone in the living room and my mother was breaking things in their bedroom. And I should add that she didn't break anything and she wants everyone to know that it's fiction. So, sorry, I'll continue on. She didn't utter any human sounds, but I could chart her progress around their room by imagining the sources of wood snapping, glass shattering, and plaster crumbling. I slipped out into the soft, watery world of Alaskan rainforest night, soundless except for the rain, and wandered in my pajamas down the other side of the street, peering in dark, low living room windows and listening at doors, until at one door I heard a humming sound that was unfamiliar to me. I went around to the side of the house, opened the screen door, and pressed my ear to cold wood. The sound seemed lower now, almost a moan, barely audible. The door was locked, but I lifted up the rubber corner of the welcome mat, and just as at our house, the key was there, so I went in. I discovered that the buzzing sound was the air pump filter on a fish tank. Something about wandering alone through someone else's house was awful, and I moved solemnly across the linoleum to take a seat high on a kitchen stool. I watched the orange and black striped fish suck at pebbles and spit them out. The tank contained larger rocks also, lava rocks with dark caves and crannies, out of which peered many tiny round fish eyes, shiny as foil. Some had bright red and blue bodies, others had bright orange bodies. I thought perhaps the fish were hungry. I went to the refrigerator and saw sweet pickles, opened the jar, and brought it back for the fish to see. I found slots on top of the tank, toward the back, and dropped the pickles in, one or two at first, then the whole jar, slice by slice, and finally poured the juice into so that the tank water swelled up and ran in beads over the side. That's actually based on a little autobiographical moment where I trashed the neighbor's house, but the rest is fiction. I stared at the pickle slices, floating brightly with the fish, some of them sinking and twirling. They bounced slowly over the bright pink and blue rocks below. The orange-striped fish had all flashed about the tank as I had been pouring, but they, too, now moved slowly. They leaned a little to one side as they swam, and several rested on the rocks. Others stretched their long, see-through cartilage mouths at the surface every few moments and sucked for air. Their side fins rippled as delicately as fine lace. When the pickle slices had settled more, they rocked like sleeping fish just beside the pink and blue gravel, and the real fish rocked silently beside them, as if in gentle groves of eelgrass and sunken lily pads. The image was beautiful, and in that moment of beauty, I strained forward. I pressed my hands and face close to the glass and gazed into the mute black core of one of those silvery eyes. I felt as if I, too, were floating, gently rocking, oddly out of place. And in that flicker of a moment, I caught myself feeling the rocking and perceiving myself perceiving, realized that I was I. This distracted me. Then I forgot what had distracted me, lost interest in the fish, and after slapping my feet across the linoleum of the kitchen floor, passed again into the soft, dark rain. Thanks again.
Thank you to David and his mother, but no more pickles for you, David. Save those fish. This year's gold medalist in First Fiction tells the story of the emotional and political dramas of pre-revolutionary Cuba. As two teens come of age, they witness the struggle across racial and social divides. This novel portrays the conflicted loyalties and complex contradictions of the characters in this chaotic and divided time. The gold medal in First Fiction goes to Telex from Cuba by Rachel Kushner.
Congratulations, Rachel. Hello. Wanted to thank the judges and also Gina Valeria and finally my family who are here tonight. I'm going to read just two pages from my book, but I wanted to add in an improvised way that I actually grew up in San Francisco, so it's particularly strange and meaningful to be here. I feel like the trajectory of my own life has become suddenly acute in a way I hadn't anticipated, because I went from being a actually scary juvenile delinquent accosting you outside on Market Street to a woman accepting an award in this private club, so it's wonderful. I wasn't really that scary. I'm exaggerating. Sorry, just a minute. I lost my place. Okay, the section I'm going to read is told from the perspective of a Frenchman who is an arms dealer, and he's in Havana, and he's trying to shake two people that are following him. That's all you need to know. The streets of the Barrio Chino were crowded now that it was no longer raining. He wove among the prostitutes and bags of rotting vegetable scraps from the chop suey houses, heat rising off the ripe pavement in gossamer waves of steam. The Barrio Chino was no pretend glamour, no pretend France. It was a marketplace of dour, pockmarked girls and boys refashioned as girls. "Hey, you," one of the boy girls said and came close, walking alongside him. "You're coming with me." She hooked an arm smoothly through Lamazière's, encircling him in a musky cloud of perfume. They strolled together. "You see, I'm just a dumb tourist looking to entertain myself," Lamazière was telegraphing to the two Cubans who were so obviously trailing him. "Just a dumb tourist looking to restore morale, shall we say, in the Barrio Chino." "Where you taking me, honey?" the hooker asked him, her Adam's apple moving up and down, barely disguised under a satin neck ribbon. "Just let me escort you." Despite her sachet, she exuded a virility that the perfume and heels couldn't conceal. "Try to rip her off," he thought, "and I bet she transforms into something more aggressive and male than I am." "Go where I go," he said, "and I'll make it worth your while." "And I'll make it worth yours," she looked him up and down approvingly. "My while and your while will go perfect." Walking with her, it occurred to Lamazière that the male virility was not a mistake, a thing she'd accidentally left showing. It seemed, instead, an integral aspect of what made her hard to refuse. The Adam's apple, her wiry arms and willowy height, the loose appeal of caked mascara rimming huge, dewy eyes, with a shadow of dark stubble on her upper lip. It wasn't his thing, but he understood that it was certainly someone's. Promising tits and ass and tuberose perfume, and at the same time covertly promising something else, but openly covertly promising this something else. If she were perfectly covert and convincing as a female, what would be the point? On his flight to Havana, Lamazière had met an Englishman who'd insisted that the male kabuki who performed in drag were more feminine than any woman. "I've just come from Japan," the Englishman said, "and if you could see these artists, the Onagata they're called, why, they make women, especially Western women, hardly seem like women at all." Lamazière doubted going to Japan would convince him that femininity was the art of walking in stilettos, that it had much to do with poise or surfaces, makeup and neck ribbons. Whatever female essence was, he had caught it only fleetingly, a thing women reflected when they were least aware. He couldn't have named this quality, but suspected it had something to do with invisibility, a remainder whose very definition was predicated on his inability to see it, like dust, a particle too fine for the sieve of his comprehension. It occurred to him that the hooker posed an amusing solution to this problem by covering feminine mystery in familiar layers, artifice, and also maleness. Underneath the layers lurked the promise of woman, but the layers were a safety net, a guarantee of putting off getting to woman, whatever she was. For those who didn't care to know, there were these sublime creatures in the Barrio Chino. He and the girl jaywalked toward a theater offering live extreme sex, or advertising it. "It isn't extreme if it happens for an audience," was Lamazière's feeling. Frosted bulbs ran in relay around the theater's sign like a circling electric tongue. In Paris, this was called Life Show, which seemed more poetic and terrible, as if what it promised was a glimpse of the secret reality that subtended all life and to which all life could be reduced. Two paid performers copulating on a square of linty, hot pink carpeting. "You're lovely," he said, handing the hooker a generous stack of bills, "but I must run." Instead of entering the main theater, he darted up the wrong stairway to be sure he'd shaken off the men following him. He found himself in a hallway outside a large room where three Chinese musicians were playing marvelously atonal music, or what he'd thought was atonal music until he figured out that they were tuning their instruments. They were diminutive men with kitty cat faces, and there wasn't the slightest trace of sex in the room. The scene moved him with its smell of rosin dust, the men producing whiny and plaintive strains in this curious rehearsal space. A sign on the theater doors facing the street had announced, "Gentlemen only, please." Here they are, Lamazière thought, watching the three musicians play, sandwiched in a building between people viewing sex and people having it. These are the gentlemen. That's it. Thank you. Oh, my plaque, of course. An afterthought. Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Our next award honors the writer who best discusses an aspect of the Golden State, the Californiana Award. Is that how you pronounce it? The author is awarded for his ingenious examination of the economic, social, and political spirit of Los Angeles through his study of the Los Angeles Plaza. By exploring the heart of the city, where the citizens live and interact daily, he has charted the story of the city by the never-ending transformations that take place of its central spaces. For his book, The Los Angeles Plaza, Sacred and Contested Spaces, we give the gold medal for Californiana to William David Estrada.
Good evening. I'm delighted and certainly honored to be here to accept this award. And after reviewing the long list of past recipients, I humbly thank the Commonwealth Club for placing my book among so many of my favorite authors. I would also like to thank my family, my wife Patricia, my daughter Amelia, son David, and my niece Aurelia, a resident of San Francisco, who are all with me tonight to celebrate in this award, as well as my colleagues back home at the Natural History Museum of LA County, especially our outstanding history department. They have all played a significant part in the journey of the Los Angeles Plaza. Tonight has added special meaning for me because two of my former mentors and friends at the UCLA History Department are former recipients of this award. Dr. Alexander Saxton in 1970 for his now classic work, The Indispensable Enemy, Labor and the Anti-Chinese Movement in California, and Dr. Gary B. Nash for his monumental 1979 work, The Urban Crucible, Social Change, Political Consciousness, and the Origins of the American Revolution. I just got an email the other day from Gary Nash. He still continues to be my friend. And Dr. Saxton turns 90 this year. I just wanted to announce that. I learned many things from these two great scholars of American history. Most of all, I learned that the best approach to writing the history of the American people, especially through the urban experience, strives to understand the daily interactions, informal conversations, economic exchanges, conflicts and compromises among men and women of diverse races, ethnicities, faiths, and economic classes. So my central goal in writing this book was to examine the complex history of change at this quintessential public space from an interdisciplinary and multi-ethnic perspective, and how this change reflects the broader history of the City of Angels. In other words, my goal was to pose new answers to the seemingly timeless question of how we became Angelinos. And in doing so, my hope is that this book might inform, or perhaps inspire, future studies on the nature of public space that seek to posit new answers to the similar question of how we became Parisians, Nairobians, Jakartans, New Yorkers, Washingtonians, and yes, how we became San Franciscans and beyond. Once again, I thank you for this award. I'm going to put on this lei because when we checked into our hotel just a couple of hours ago, this lei was waiting for me, a gift from my colleagues back at the Natural History.
Very becoming, Islay. Now it's time to award the medals for nonfiction. An amazing lineup of finalists. The finalists are Philip Fradkin, Wallace Stegner in the American West, Michael Meyer for The Last Days of Old Beijing, Leonard Mlodinow for The Drunkard's Walk, and this year's silver medal is awarded to the story of the wild horse in the history of the American West. Tracing the history of the Mustang all the way back to its evolutionary ancestry, this reveals how the wild horse has shaped our history, culture, and perceptions of the American West. Please join me in congratulating our silver medalist in nonfiction, Deanne Stillman, for Mustang, the saga of the wild horse in the American West. Oh, is Deanne here? Oh, come on up. Don't be shy.
Well, I've podiumed, and I can't believe it. I've been wanting to use podium as a verb like they do in the Olympics. It's so bizarre. And then I thought, are they calling silver medalists? But yes, I guess they are. So thank you so much to the Commonwealth Club for this wonderful award, and Gina Bellaria, and everybody at my publisher, Houghton Mifflin, some of whom are no longer there and some of whom are, but wherever they are, they've been fantastic for me and have understood from the get-go what we are doing to the horse we rode in on and why it's so important that we try to preserve our heritage. So I would like to single out Janet Silver, Anton Mueller, Patrice Tadonio, Nicole Angeloro, and Michelle Bonanno. Okay, I would first like to tell you a bit about why I wrote this book. I was finishing up my previous book 10 years ago, 29 Palms, a true story of murder Marines in the Mojave, about two girls who were killed by a Marine after the Gulf War in 29 Palms, California. And I learned that 34 wild horses had been gunned down outside Christmas time at Reno. This was in 1998. Two of the accused were Marines, and one was stationed at 29 Palms. So because of that and the fact that I had grown up around horses and have a lifelong involvement with them, I really felt compelled to investigate what we are doing to our great icon and partner. So I just want to read you a few pages about... a few pages from my book. The first thing I learned as I began to look into this massacre is that in the American West, a bizarre war is underfoot. It is a variation of the old range wars of the 19th century, and it is waged by stockmen and sagebrush rebels with copies of the Second Amendment tucked into their back pockets, and it is backed by Republicans and Democrats and a federal agency that circumvents the wild free-roaming horses and burro act of 1971, along with small-town officials who march to the great American battle cry, "Don't tread on me." Their target is the wild horse, and the war rages most intensely in Nevada, where more than 50% of the country's remaining Mustangs still roam. The first time I saw Mustangs in the wild, it was as if I had come home. There they were on a hillside near Reno, grazing, making their way down. They were a small band of mares and foals that had not yet shed their winter coats, and in every way they were perfect. A stallion stood nearby and watched. I walked through some brush to greet them. Surely they would be excited to see me, I thought. After all, I'm here to tell their story, and can't they tell that I like them? I flattened my hand and extended it palm up, a gesture that domestic horses take as a sign of friendship, especially when the hand has an apple or a carrot. But the Mustangs ran away, and I was crushed. The feeling only added to my sadness. It was just a few months after members of their herd had been gunned down in the massacre that I had read about in a desert bar. From the moment I saw this story, I started to make inquiries. Soon I began traveling to Nevada to find out what happened. Over time, I got to know a wide range of people. I talked to the first people to arrive on the scene, and the detectives who were horrified as, day after day, the body count got higher. I talked to people who were dismayed that Mustangs were under siege and to those who wanted them gone. But most important, I began visiting the Virginia range where the Mustangs are living and dying. I grew up around racehorses and show horses, and later, when I moved to the West, logged a lot of time exploring the desert on horseback. But the only place I had seen Mustangs was on television and in the movies. That's not how you approach them, my guide said when the Mustangs ran away. I was accustomed to being around domestic horses, and it was difficult to realize these horses were actually wild. A few days later, I returned and tried it again. This time, the horses were crossing a gully deep in the range. My guide stopped the truck, and we got out. She demonstrated a kind of sideways walk in which you move toward the horses on a diagonal so they can see you fully and not feel threatened. Don't stare at them, she said. I followed the instruction and tried to erase myself, edging quietly into their territory. For a while, they didn't move. I could see their ears twitch and hear them breathe. And in the sky, a hawk rode a thermal. The moment was primal and basic, and since then I have visited them many times. I have thought about the Mustang Massacre for years. To this day, I try to understand why someone would kill them. I have read thousands of pages of trial testimony and forensic reports and lists of what shells were found where and who said what to whom in the days before and after the crime. I have even met men who carry automatic weapons and go into the desert to kill things. Once one of them asked me for a date. I declined, explaining that I wouldn't be able to listen to his stories. That's okay, he said. I won't tell you. In one of his novels, Tim O'Brien wrote that people go to war out of love, not patriotism. As they go about the business of destruction, they acquire nicknames that they savor and are later ashamed of, and they become intimate in the performance of certain acts and the knowledge that they did it and in the silence or acclaim that follows. They are the only ones who know how and why an incident occurred, and then sometimes they don't. Their pathologies sync up with greater forces, and in the wide open space, things happen. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Deanne. What a sad story. This year's gold medalist in nonfiction has crafted a thoughtful and candid memoir about his life in the 1970s music scene. In his original and exciting look at contemporary culture, his story offers an intimate look into the struggle between composing serious music in a society obsessed with pop. The gold medal in nonfiction goes to John Adams for Hallelujah Junction, Composing an American Life. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. I'm terrifically honored to get this because, you know, I don't consider myself an author. I spend most of my time pushing little black dots around music paper. And the idea for this actually came from an abortive biography, a biographical study that a professor was going to do about my work, and I spent a long time, over a period of a year and a half, working with him and going back through my memory. And then he had a horrible case of writer's block, and I was so frustrated at the loss of all that time that I said, well, I'll do it myself. And I'd had some inspiration because just before then I'd been reading the just phenomenally wonderful, warm and human memoir or autobiography of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, which has all the same characters in it as 100 Years of Solitude, only the real ones. And I was very inspired by how an author could tell the story of his life, the blossoming of his creativity, but also just how rich his environment, all the people that he grew up with in the small town. And I realized that I'd had a pretty interesting childhood, and the 90-year-old Iroquois Indian that my parents had bought their farmhouse from in New Hampshire, who always kept his own night soil and read only the farm journal. And my first experiences playing clarinet in a community orchestra that was sponsored by the New Hampshire State Mental Hospital. And my first composition, which was performed in front of an audience of severely mentally disabled people who loved my music, and gave me a tremendous intuition about the communicative power of music. So I wrote this book. I wrote it at a very inopportune time. I wrote it at the same time that I was composing the opera Dr. Atomic, which is about the creation of the atomic bomb and J. Robert Oppenheimer. And it was a funny thing to do. I had my laptop on a table in my studio, and I would compose until I got sick of it, and then I'd turn around and write some more of my memoir, which is called Hallelujah Junction. Which actually is a little place. It's a tiny crossroads up in the Gold Country near where I and my family have a little cabin. It's also a book about the immigrants' experience, because I, like so many people I know, and probably half the people in this room, am an immigrant to California. I came here from New England, and Hallelujah Junction documents that trip. Maybe some of you might have read that it was excerpted in the New Yorker last August under the title Sonic Youth. And for me, the gesture of coming west was not only a physical one, but a spiritual one. And I write a great deal about the California experience and what it meant to me, how it opened me up as a creative person. I'd come here very locked up and very creatively constipated. I knew I wanted to be a composer, but there was something about my East Coast environment and all the colleges and the theory and the teaching that had bound me. And coming to California had unbound me. So in a sense, it's a book full of gratitude for the experience of being able to flourish as an artist here. So for that reason, winning this particular award means all the more to me. So thank you very much.
We have that professor with a writer's block to thank for John's wonderful memoir. Now we turn to poetry, and the finalists are Victoria Chang for Salvina Molesta, G.S. Giscombe for Prairie Style, Cecilia Wallach for Narcissus, and this year's silver medalist is an extremely versatile poet whose personal style, or whose personal touch yet deeply universality, impressed the jurors. Inspired by the Jewish tradition of studying portions of the Torah weekly, his poems touch on everything from faith and doubt to family ties, love and war in a wide variety of styles. We present the Silver Medal in Poetry to Dan Belm for Practice.
Thank you to my cheering section. And thank you to the Commonwealth Club for this wonderful honor. It's a privilege to be here. And I do want to thank my friends and family who are here, the members of 16 Rivers Press who are here. We're a small, collectively run poetry press succeeding at what we do. This is our 10th anniversary, and this is a great honor for our press as well. So thank you. And I want to thank my husband, Yoel, and our son, Adam. Yes, we are still married legally in a state where it's no longer legal for us to get married. So what a world. So yes, this book is structured around the weekly practice of studying the Torah, but I would say also the equally Jewish practice of not believing everything you read. So much so it's built into our tradition too, that when we say the blessing of thanks for the commandment to engage in the study of Torah, that verb la'asok, which is translated often as engage in, can just as easily mean contend, wrestle, fight, argue. So I've tried to do that too. And I hope that in some good way I've moved a few strands of the argument forward. I'll leave you with a title poem. It was the seventh anniversary of my father's death. And among other things, the portion from the book of Deuteronomy that week said, "Every seventh year you shall practice forgiveness of debts." So I thought, great. So this is, like many of the pieces in the book, it's more or less in sonnet form, and it's called Practice. How simple it ought to be to practice compassion on someone gone, even love him, long as he's not right there in front of me. For I turned to address him as I do, and saw that no one's lived in that spot for quite some time. Oh, turner away of prayer. Not much of a god, but he was never meant to be. For the seventh time, I light him a candle. An entire evening and morning it burns. Not a light to see by, more a reminder of light, a remainder in a glass with a prayer on the label and a barcode from the store. How can he go on? He can't. Then let him pass away. He gave what light he could. What more will I claim? What debt of grace he doesn't owe. If I forgive him, he is free to go. Thank you very much.
This year's gold medalist for poetry is a poet who, in his collection of both new and previously published poems, reveals his extraordinary inventiveness and brilliance. His experiments with tone, form, and length have resulted in a richly textured anthology of one of the best contemporary poets. We give the gold medal in poetry to August Kleinsoller for Sleeping It Off in Rapid City.
Thank you. I'm very honored. I have a long, warm relationship with the Commonwealth Club. Not long after I arrived in San Francisco, I got a job teaching English as a second language to foreign executives. And on Friday afternoons, I think it was, we got to take them to Commonwealth Club lectures, which were uniformly excellent, as the vegetables were uniformly overcooked. And together it was very enjoyable. The title of my book came about rather unusually, the way titles often do, is sort of a hypnagogic moment, a sleeping and waking moment, where the title "Sleeping It Off in Rapid City" came to me, and I decided that I'd call my next book Sleeping It Off in Rapid City. And then it occurred to me I'd have to write a poem called Sleeping It Off in Rapid City. And then it occurred to me that I would have to go to Rapid City I tried to explain this to my wife, my former wife, and she was exercised first that she wasn't invited along, and second because she's from Fargo, North Dakota, and Rapid City is in South Dakota, and as she pointed out, I was reluctant to visit her family in Fargo. This was a deep affront, but a boy's got to do what a boy's got to do, and I went there, and it's for those of you who've been there or haven't been there, it's quite an extraordinary place with the Black Hills on to the southwest and the Badlands to the east, and Rapid City itself is just one of these devastated American nightmares of highway and malls that had once been a place and no longer is, but it has a little bit of a nucleus of a center, and but otherwise it's a dump. But they do have a wonderful restaurant there called the Corn Exchange, which is sort of a rustic chez Panisse, and in that they it's terrific really and expensive like chez Panisse. But everything's meat. You know, they have 8 different types of pork chop and 12 different types of steak from this ranch, you know, and organically fed and whatnot. And so I spent every night there, you know, a lonely older gentleman sitting in the corner drinking his wine and eating his piece of meat. And at one point they asked me, where are you visiting from? And I said, San Francisco. And they said, oh, our chef used to cook at Zuni's. So I said, well, you have a wonderful chef, which they did, and a couple of years went by, and I had a book called Sleeping It Off in Rapid City, and a friend of mine was visiting Rapid City, and he said, what should I do? And I said, well, why don't you go into the Corn Exchange and see if you can find that chef who used to work at Zuni, and maybe they'll put the book in the window. And maybe they did, I don't know. But thank you very much.
Well, let's hear it for wonderful books and the club's overcooked vegetables. Thank you so much for celebrating some of the great literary works of 2008 with us and for helping us commemorate our 78th annual California Book Awards. Thank you as well to Dr. Martha Cox, a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and active participant in the Book Awards Planning Committee. I'm Julia Flynn Seiler, author of The House of Mondavi, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. One more thing I wanted to mention. Winning authors will be signing their books in the library. Each and every winning book is for sale in the library. Let's support buying books, too.